gonna happen.
Good afternoon, I'm Kate Manahan, and thank you for joining me for the 109th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During this show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Toho Soma, whose family moved to the United States in 1972 for his father's job with a Japanese electronics company. Toho was born and raised in California, where he lived with his parents and his older brother, speaking Japanese at home and visiting Japan regularly during his summers. He brings a perspective as a first-generation immigrant to the show today and will also be offering his insights as Portland's public health director. I'm just delighted to have you here today. Thank you so much for coming in this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks. So let's start with your parents. Can you tell us about where they were from and what their plan was when they came to the United States?
Sure. So my mother is from Tokyo originally, and my dad grew up in Kyoto, and they met in Tokyo through work. And like you said, they came over to California in 1972 for my dad's work. He worked for an electronics company, and they initially started out in Los Angeles, and they came with my brother, who was 6 months old at the time. And from what I know is they really weren't quite sure how long they'd be staying. So when I was born in 74, they had already moved up to the San Francisco Bay Area, but they gave me a Japanese name because they thought at the time that they'd be all moving back, or we'd all be moving back to Japan before I started school. And they thought it was just going to be a temporary stay in the U.S.
And what does Toho mean?
So Toho means to walk on the earth, which is kind of fitting. I do enjoy walking a lot, and I enjoy physical activity.
Yeah, and you walked over today.
I did walk over today.
On the earth.
Yes, and Portland's a great walkable city.
Yes, it is.
In many ways, so.
Love that.
Mm-hmm.
So it is really hard to predict your future. Did things work out as planned for your family to go back to Japan?
So no, they didn't. So we have not moved back to Japan, and, you know, I don't know when that happened, when that decision was made. I remember very vague conversations when I was really young about possibly moving back to Japan, but it just never materialized. And so I think my dad really enjoyed his job, and I assume the company really enjoyed having him in the U.S. and running the show in the U.S. And they would be able to build a nice community of both Japanese people and non-Japanese people. You know, I think it was a great blessing to grow up in the Bay Area in California, where there was a significant Japanese and Japanese American community and Asian community in general. And so we've been in the U.S. ever since. Things didn't necessarily turn out how they probably imagined, 40 plus years later. So, you know, now we're all spread out all over the country. So I'm here in Maine with my husband. And my brother is outside of Houston with his family. My parents actually are divorced, which I doubt that they envisioned would be happening when they moved to the U.S. But, you know, it's life, and that happens to a lot of families. So I think ultimately, you know, I don't think they have any regrets for, you know, being here this long and staying here this long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was it like being a Japanese kid in the Bay Area in the 70s and 80s? What kinds of things did you do with your Japanese community there and otherwise?
Sure. So, again, like I said, it's a pretty significant size population. There's a Japantown in San Jose, which is near the biggest city near where I grew up. There's obviously Japantown in San Francisco as well. And so my brother and I went to Japanese school every Saturday to learn Japanese, the language as well as the culture. And there were many, many other kids like us, kids whose parents had come from Japan. Also say in California and on the West Coast, there's also a significant Japanese American community that is very different from us, which is those who had been here in the U.S. for many previous generations and were interred in the internment camps during World War II. And that's something that's a completely different experience than I'm, you know, familiar with at all. But obviously adds another layer of history and whatever you want to call it, just experience, you know, that is a very different immigrant experience than my immigrant experience.
Well, extremely different immigrant experience than any other immigrants have ever had,
right,
in this country.
Yeah.
Was there a place that people went to after the internment was over?
So from what I know about the history of the internment, they lost, you know, whatever businesses they had, the homes they had.
And property.
Right, and property. And so I think they just had to rebuild. And so they went to, again, some of the larger urban centers like San Francisco and rebuilt. And, you know, you have great little enclaves like Japantown, which, you know, I lived in San Francisco after college for 8 years, and it is my favorite neighborhood by far. Hanging out in Japantown.
Mm-hmm. Is there good food there?
There's amazing food.
What kind of foods would you go get if you went today?
Oh, there's obviously some great sushi and some ramen. There's this great, this little mochi shop, which is those little rice cakes, and desserts, sweets, whatever.
Sounds fun.
And the grocery stores there as well, so which have a lot of Japanese products.
Oh, are there things that you can't get here that you would like to be able to get for cooking?
In Maine? In Maine, it's certainly not like California, but I think there's enough Asian markets, and Boston's only 2 hours away where if I really, really need something. So I've not been wanting too much.
I had a guest who eats halal up in central Maine, and he just has everything FedExed or UPSed.
Yeah. That works too.
His meat comes in from Iowa or something like that. So what was the hardest thing for your family to deal with as immigrants in California, do you think?
Well, I think it was especially hard for my mom because, you know, my dad was the one, the impetus was for his job. And so he kind of had a network already built in terms of coworkers, both Japanese and American coworkers who could kind of show him the ropes. You know, my mom came over and she didn't speak much English at all. You know, she has a high school education. And for her, it was difficult to kind of find her own community. So, again, from what my parents had told me, we had some really nice neighbors in Los Angeles. And they were the ones to really show her, teach her the language. She took English classes, but also teach her kind of the American customs. So she has related to me an anecdote about their first Thanksgiving. So this is before I was born, but you know, she wanted to kind of assimilate and try an American custom, but she had never cooked a turkey before. And so
why would she?
Exactly. So it's not even about learning about the significance of Thanksgiving. It was about, you know, the cooking. And so apparently their neighbor in the apartment complex showed her how to make a turkey. And I don't know how successful it was, but, you know, I think for her, again, the biggest challenge was finding a community. You know, I can see why, how a lot of immigrants may feel very isolated when they get here, especially when it's not necessarily their choice to come here. And if you don't have an existing community or know how to find an existing community or access anything like that, it's a lot of stress.
Yeah. Especially if you're home with the kids.
Right.
You sometimes don't have that conduit.
Yeah. So, I absolutely. And if she's the one who has to work with the school, if something happens, you know, and they don't translate materials, they don't have an expert, you know, that can help, you know, facilitate that discussion, it's really challenging. So, you know, I look here at Portland and their multilingual, multicultural center, and it's great. I love it because I don't think my mom had that benefit when we were kids.
Right.
And I could see how she might have really appreciated that.
Were there even English learner classes in your school system at the time?
Not at the time. I'll tell you that growing up, though, maybe when I was around 7 or 8, We started getting them. We got a lot of refugees from Southeast Asia, and, you know, a significant number where they had to build, you know, classrooms and trailers to house everyone. And that's, I think, when the ELL program developed, at least in my school district.
And I think across the country, it was a new idea at that time. Yeah. So what were some of your memories from the times you spent with friends and family back when you visited Kyoto and Tokyo during your summer visits there?
Sure. So we used to go back to Japan every other summer and spend the entire summer. So 3 months there. And my dad would go and work, and my mom would just take us around and be in charge of our daily activities. So we were the only ones who lived in the U.S. at the time. And so all my cousins lived in Japan, and all our family friends lived in Japan. And so it was every day was just kind of different. We just kind of set out, and my mom would have a budget, and we just kind of go out and do stuff. Sometimes it would be something kind of special, like going to Tokyo Disneyland. Sometimes it would just be kind of a day of errands and shopping and hanging out with the grandparents. But I just recall every day was just kind of an adventure, and it was great. And then we'd spend, so our home base would be in Tokyo, and then we kind of go out and take the train and spend a week here or there in different parts of Japan to see family and friends. And then we also took some trips where we didn't know anybody, but it was, since we're in Japan, let's go explore a different part of Japan. So I remember my mom, my brother, and I took a ferry up to Hokkaido, which is the northernmost island, and I don't even know if she had ever been there, but we spent a few days there, and it was great. Just being able to practice your Japanese, practice your reading skills.
I think that's really lucky that you get to spend so much time there as a child.
Right.
Formative years, you get to really understand your family's background.
Yeah. And again, growing up in California, that didn't seem such a weird concept. I had friends whose parents were Danish, and I had friends whose parents were Chinese, and they, you know, they would also go away for significant periods of time to all these countries and to see family. And so it was never, I guess I didn't realize how fortunate I was to get those experiences.
Yeah. When you were friends with people from all over the world as a kid, did you ever talk about that with them, or did you really have more in common around baseball or
music? The day-to-day, the, you know, being at school kind of thing, so that kids bond over. But, you know, I think of how at home we'd speak Japanese, or at a certain point I would stop speaking Japanese and they'd still speak me Japanese and I'd answer in English. And that is a very common experience for a lot of people like me whose parents came over from a different country, where it doesn't sound weird. And so I know some of my friends do it as well. And that's just a thing.
I do. I hear about this, and it is fascinating to me, having a conversation in two separate languages at the same time.
Right, because in your head, it makes perfect sense, you know? You're translating in your head as it happens.
Yeah, I wish everyone had access to having two languages in their head. Yeah. So what do your parents think of your work as a public servant now, as the public health director of the city of Portland?
I think they're proud of me I my undergrad degree is in anthropology, and then I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life after college, and I kind of bounced around different things, and my first job out of college was working at a mental health clinic for people living with HIV and AIDS. And I had no concept really of public health as a career or as a field of study, but my job was very administrative, but part of it, we had a research project going, and it was, you know, looking at the effects of different types of counseling and the outcomes on that. And it really kind of interested me, because I've also had an interest in math and just research and just being a curious sort of person. So I had the very great fortune at that time living in San Francisco and having UC Berkeley, you know, next door across the bay. And so I looked into public health for a master's degree, and I was fortunate enough to get in. And so that's really kind of when things kind of cemented in my head about what I want to do for a career, which is public health. So I got my master's from UC Berkeley, and now the fact that I get to actually apply my degree in a very direct way. I think from a practical standpoint, kind of pleases my parents.
Yes.
But also, I think from an emotional way, the fact that I'm, you know, I found something that really excites me also, you know, makes them really happy.
Yes, and changes people's lives for the better.
Yeah.
Making stronger communities.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be so proud if you were my son. It would be weird if you were my son since we're so close in age. You're listening to WMPG, and if you're just joining us, welcome. This is New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Toho Soma. His family was originally from Japan, and he was raised in California, attended Johns Hopkins in Baltimore and Berkeley in California, got his master's degree in public health focusing on epidemiology and biostatistics. He is now the director of public health for the city of Portland. Let's start with the idea of public health, Toho. It's charged with a big mission. On your website, it says the mission is to improve the health of all people in the community by working together to prevent disease, promote health, and protect residents from environmental threats. How do you make these goals a reality on a day-to-day basis from your office?
Sure. So, yeah, it does sound like a huge mission, and it kind of is, and that's why... in terms of my day-to-day work, it is looking, kind of assessing what the big issues are, both in terms of, so you could say, gaps in service or health issues, as well as what assets are out in the community. And so kind of putting those side by side, how do we address some of the gaps using the assets we have? So a lot of our work is very collaborative. We know we can't do it all. We know also in Portland there's a lot of great resources. So whether it's hospitals, you know, traditional health and public health partners, you might think of like hospitals and social service, but also some very non-traditional ones. You know, we partner with schools a lot. We partner with institutes of higher education and businesses to try to address different population health issues. So we run about 80% of our budget is based on grants. And so a grant, 80%, yes.
That's
so grants, yeah. So grants kind of dictate our day-to-day activities in terms of, you know, what they want to see happen ultimately with the end of the grant. But we're always just kind of thinking about what's next, and so, you know, looking out for new grants that might address a particular health issue that we haven't talked about before.
That's kind of exciting. Do you have specific groups that you might look for grants for?
Sure. You know, at least pertaining to the immigrant community, we have community health outreach workers, or we've had a history of community health outreach workers. And these are peers who are trained to work within their community on whatever health topic. And we've used them to sign people up for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. We've done things around health fairs and around cancer screening or diabetes screening or things like that. And so it might be a grant to kind of bolster that program up, because sometimes we've kind of lacked funding and haven't had the capacity or the number of community health outreach workers that we really feel we need and, you know, and want.
My understanding is you're pretty proactive on how you get out there and meet these communities, too. Arriving at a soccer game and doing screenings there, where you might find a number of people from different communities. Is that your office doing that?
That was our office in the past, but we do like to, that's what I, when I say, you know, we use the assets in the community to kind of address issues. So instead of creating a new group to talk about, say, you know, STD and HIV testing, we may go to an ethnic market or to a place of worship and kind of go in through that avenue, because we know people are going to be there, and we develop a relationship first with them so that they trust us, because trust is so important. And then we can go in, build the trust, talk to the community, and then kind of introduce different health topics. And a lot of them, things like HIV and STD testing or substance use, are highly stigmatized and sensitive topics to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Violence prevention.
All of that, right. And especially with immigrant communities and their particular needs and perceptions of those health issues. So, again,
looking at the assets we have rather than kind of building up new groups for our benefit.
Yeah. So you said that public health is, the goal of it is to make healthy choice the easy choice. And I wondered if you could say more about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a tagline that you say a lot when people ask what public health is all about. So, you know, a great example is, at least in Portland, you can turn on your tap and feel confident that you can drink that tap water. And so the healthy choice is the easy choice. You don't have to necessarily get your water tested every time you want to take a shower or take a drink from your tap. But you look in the news and see places like Flint, Michigan, where that hasn't been the case recently. And that is where public health needs to intervene. So people are protected. And so, you know, hopefully everyone also, when they get in a vehicle, puts on their seatbelt, and it's just second nature. And so we want to make that healthy choice the easy choice.
Right.
And so that's what it's about.
Becomes habit when it's so easy and it's expected.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
That kind of thing saves the community a lot of resources too down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Less fatalities in a car accident, for instance.
Exactly.
And then everybody wins.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love that. So, in general, why do you tell people public health matters?
So I tell people public health matters because it is everywhere, and it's, again, not even just run through our public health department in the city. And so it runs through, say, our public works. When we're clearing sidewalks, it's so you don't fall and or slip on the ice, and that is to protect your health. You know, when people come and take your garbage and recycling every week, that is because of hygiene, and you don't want to have your neighborhood infested with rats and things like that. And so public health is everywhere. And again, it is not just a government function. It runs through all sorts of facets of life. And so, you know, we feel that without good health, it's really hard to really lead a quality life. So we're talking about not just increasing the length of life, but also increasing the quality of life for people.
I love that. And when you can take some of the obstacles out of the way, people can give what their gift is, you know, contribute in the way they were born to share their gifts with the world.
Right.
And what a loss when you don't have that.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a concept like food deserts, for instance, and those are communities where people don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, and they have to do, you know, a lot of their shopping at a corner gas station and buy packaged foods and processed foods that are loaded with unhealthy things. And you can see the effects of how place is such an important factor in one's health. You know, they've shown, I think it was in D.C., where they showed the life expectancy at different metro stops, and you can see down this, you know, I think it was the red line, how if you go from a rich suburb down to other parts of D.C., your life expectancy decreases significantly. And a lot of it is based on place, and therefore access to healthy foods, access to physical activity opportunities.
Education.
Education, absolutely. Access to clinics.
It's a sad reality.
It is a sad reality. There's a lot of inequality. And, you know, we're public health, like I said, we do a lot of work based on what the grants tell us, but we also want to try to get more at these social determinants of health. So things like education level, poverty, discrimination, those play a lot into health outcomes. And, you know, those are the kind of roots of health inequalities as well.
We're learning a lot about how stress results in later life diabetes, heart disease, and other chronic diseases that we're seeing more and more of. So it really matters if you're raising a young family in squalor and in hunger and food deserts. It affects their life expectancy rates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so good work out there.
Thank you.
How does your firsthand understanding of life as an immigrant yourself impact your work as the director of public health?
Sure. So, you know, again, like I said, when growing up, my mom didn't have access to a place like the multicultural office that Portland Public Schools has. And we have partnered with them in the past, and we hope to always partner with them in the future. And I look at that, and it's a great resource that I think every community should have. And so that, you know, being cognizant and aware of we need to do this is definitely colored by my own experience, my own childhood.
Yeah, you get the human impact there.
Right.
Yeah. What kinds of services would you direct immigrants to your office to receive or to learn more information about?
Sure. So there are some other great organizations in the greater Portland area that provide services, health services and social services. You know, the Maine Access Immigrant Network, they've got a great team of community health outreach workers. We refer people to ILAP, the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, because, you know, again, health, and it's another social determinant of health, your immigration status. And so that's a great resource. The International Clinic at Maine Medical Center is a great help. Greater Portland Health, our local federally qualified health center, sees a lot of people from the immigrant community. And they also have a lot of cultural competence around that issue.
Great. Toho, I love how you're able to apply what you believe in and all that you've learned about health and of a population to benefit our whole community. Your work's profoundly needed, and we see the gap between rich and poor widen. I'm so grateful for the work that you do, and thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I'm Kate Manahan in the studio with my guest, Toho Soma. Toho, would you be kind enough to introduce the song you've selected for closing today's program?
Sure. So this song is called Vector by Shugo Tokumaru, a Japanese artist.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Back to 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 back